It's Friday, the 15th of April. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up, a contentious debate between the Democrat Party and presidential hopefuls as Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton spar.
He cannot come up with any example because there is no example.
We'll talk with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone about that. There has been yet another earthquake in Japan. We'll have the latest for you. And an Eastern European country is changing its name, sort of. You'll hear more about that. It's all ahead on International Edition. We get today's presentation underway with a look at the latest chapter of the story of the U.S. political scene heading toward the next presidential election. Last night, it was the turn of the candidates of the Democrat Party. Candidates Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, they engaged in what could only be termed a contentious debate last night in New York, 5 days ahead of the state's very important primary election. There were candidates' aggressive exchanges to most questions, including Sanders repeating doubts about Clinton's judgment because of her support for the war in Iraq and acceptance of campaign funding from banks and firms on Wall Street. But Sanders failed to back up his claim that Clinton showed banks favor when she was a senator.
The proper response, in my view, is we should break them up. And that's what my legislation does.
Well, as you can tell, Dana, he cannot come up with any example because there is no example. And it is important. It's always important. It may be inconvenient, but it's always important to get the facts straight.
Clinton called Sanders' concentration on her accepting large contributions from Wall Street a phony attack. Both candidates agreed that banks regarded as too big to fail or a risk to the economy and should be broken up. But that is where their consensus mostly ended. Both have large followings in New York, but polls going into Thursday night's debate show Clinton with a double-digit lead over Sanders statewide. Clinton also has a large lead in the delegate count, making the New York contest even more significant as she moves closer to reaching the delegate count to clinch the nomination. Joining us is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, in your opinion, did either Sanders or Clinton help him or herself by last night's get-together?
I would say that neither really hurt themselves, and what that means is status quo in the race. Let's take the New York primary. The latest Marist poll, which is out following the debate, Clinton has a 17-point lead over Bernie Sanders. Clinton is drawing great support in the New York City area and in the immediate suburbs. Clinton and Sanders are much more competitive in the more rural sections upstate in places where the economies have been more depressed. But here's the bottom line on this. Clinton appears headed for an impressive victory in New York, according to the polls. And that's going to slow the recent Sanders momentum and reaffirm the fact that Clinton remains the strong front runner in the Democratic race.
Why in New York? They both have New York backgrounds. In fact, Bernie Sanders was born in New York City. Hillary Clinton was a senator from New York State. Why are they placed the way you think they are?
Oh, there's another candidate with New York roots, but I forget his name right
now.
Yeah,
who might that be?
That's Mr. Trump. Uh-huh. No, they do both have New York ties for sure, but it's the voting pattern seems one that will favor Clinton, a large state with a large, diverse population, a large number of African-American voters, Hispanic voters. That pattern has shown those states go for Hillary Clinton, sometimes by big margins. Bernie Sanders does well when he focuses on young people, on white progressives, but in smaller states that tend to hold caucus events where more committed followers come out to vote. So if the pattern holds, the fact that Bernie Sanders was born and raised in Brooklyn won't mean a lot in this upcoming primary. I think it's going to reestablish Clinton on her route to the nomination, and it's probably going to frustrate the Sanders followers who have had momentum, who do see the message resonating with liberal Democrats, but who don't seem to be able to find a way to slow her down or cut into her delegate lead, which at the end of the day is what's going to win her the nomination the way things are going.
What about the issues that were discussed yesterday? They were pretty substantive for the most part. Are these the issues that might make a difference if a voter is yet to decide for whom to vote?
Not as much as the personal acrimony. I think this is an issue for the Democrats moving forward, and one that's a bit of a danger zone right now. The longer this goes on, and Sanders has said it'll go on to the convention. He may not be able to win the nomination, but he wants a role in shaping the party platform, maybe in the selection of a vice presidential nominee. Who knows? The problem is, the more you have these testy exchanges like we saw on Thursday night, it reinforces the sort of bad blood between the two candidates. It's going to make it more challenging for them to come together at the end of this process and unite to take on the Republicans. Now, does this always a huge warning sign? No, because in 2008, we saw how it worked between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They were able to pull the party together, and they won a victory in the November election.
And both. Jim Malone, thanks so much for being with us. And Jim will join us periodically with the latest in the U.S. political scenario. VOA Steve Miller joins us now in studio. And Steve's been following this second earthquake in as many days in southern part of Japan. The same as yesterday, the same area, right?
Same area, Kumamoto in the Kyushu prefecture, this latest set of earthquakes measure a pair. Actually, the first one came in at a magnitude of 7.1 at a depth of 7 kilometers. The second one, short time after, 7.4 magnitude at a depth of 40 kilometers. And a tsunami warning has been issued.
Well, we don't know much more. I mean, we do know after hearing information yesterday that there are some nuclear power plants or at least one in the area. We don't know if it's on the coast. We don't know what's happening. But, of course, in relation to Fukushima, you have to worry about that. And I'm sure they are, especially with a tsunami advisory in effect.
Correct. There's a long distance between where the Daiichi plant was and this. I do have some colleagues that are in Japan, and they were saying that in and around the Kyushu prefecture, there are a lot of rumblings, that they felt the aftershocks more than 100 from the earthquake the other day. Haven't been able to contact them at this point.
VOA Steve Miller, he's following this, and you can follow it as well with the Voice of America on VOA, both on the air and online at voanews.com.
And now for a look at social media, I'm joined by editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, earlier this week, Facebook had their F8 developer conference, and this is an opportunity for Facebook to announce some of the new things that they're working on. One of those things you may see kind of up front is with the profile picture. Now, last fall, Facebook allowed people to kind of do these little looping videos as their profile picture on Facebook, and now they're partnering some different apps to allow people to better capture that. So you may see better ways to do that. You may see more people start to have these little looping videos as their profile pictures as they incorporate this. They've also announced a camera that can film in 360 degrees.
Oh.
So more the virtual reality, you know, the idea that if you're filming in 360 degrees, you'll be able to put on a headset and view those videos in 360 degrees or so if you're actually there. The camera is a little pricey. It's about $15,000 is one price that I saw for it. But it is open source, so they will, you know, allow you to kind of tinker with it. And I think that that's one of their ways to improve the product and get it into more hands where people can kind of play with it and kind of do that testing that they would otherwise do. And all of this is part of Facebook's kind of business plan for the next 10 years. CEO Mark Zuckerberg talked a lot about the next 10 years and where he sees it going. And I think he really wants to make it into a one-stop kind of internet shop. You have, you know, the video elements and all these different multimedia elements. Also, their partnerships with some news organizations to have news articles directly on Facebook. So we're seeing it continue to grow and grow. It's already a huge multi-billion dollar company. And as indicated by this F8 conference, Mark Zuckerberg thinks it's only going to get bigger from here. And all indications are that it will. So we'll have to track that and over the next months and years, see where it goes and how it grows.
Just think it started in a dorm.
And it started in a dorm.
Thanks very much, Andrew. That's Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA is continuing its preparations for future manned voyages to deep space destinations such as Mars. One of the many issues they are addressing is the need for comfortable but efficient small living areas for astronauts while they're so far from Earth. NASA will be trying out a new module that, when fully deployed, will expand its compressed size of about 2 meters in length and diameter to about 4 meters. This new module is called the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, or BEAM, and it's scheduled for installation at the International Space Station on April 16th. According to NASA, the installation should take about 4 hours and will involve technicians from Mission Control in Houston and astronauts aboard the ISS. Astronauts will first go into the module about a week after expansion and will occasionally return over its 2-year test mission to retrieve data. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. There's some very interesting doings in the business world today. That is the focus of International Edition's Joe Melandrino, just steps away from Wall Street near the southern tip of Manhattan. Joe, one of the biggest topics that we're dealing with lately has been the oil market. That's in the headlines today, right?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be in the headlines all weekend. And the traders will be waiting on bated breath to see if any resolution comes out of Doha, Qatar this weekend, where you're going to have big oil production giants like Russia and Saudi Arabia trying to make some sort of deal to get production under control. The supply glut is so huge across the globe. Nobody wants to cut production. The only big player that has is the U.S. Iran said it is not coming to the table for this meeting. So if Saudi Arabia and Russia can ink a deal over the weekend, this could be tremendous for the markets on Monday. Expectations are pretty high for this, so they're really going to have to come through, not just with an oil freeze because we're at production records right now, but an actual cut to get the supply glut under control.
So what kind of effect will this have as far as the earnings season is concerned?
Well, in addition to the big meeting on Sunday out of Doha, we have a huge earnings calendar next week. We want to see what happens in the energy patch because that will impact the S&P. But we also are going to look to numbers out of Google, Microsoft, IBM, Netflix. It is a big earnings calendar. We even have big international conglomerates, GE, Caterpillar, Honeywell, rounding out the week next week. There is a lot of data for traders to contend with next week, and it could be some very interesting trading.
Joe Melandrino is our business reporter on International Edition. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
How would you like a water bottle that you never have to fill? How about knowing what's inside something you're about to eat? Well, those are just some of the items described by VOA's Kevin Enochs in his column at voanews.com. And Kevin joins us on International Edition. Kevin, let's start with this water bottle that refills itself. How's this thing work?
Well, it's created by an Austrian company named Fontis. And actually, they're crowdfunding their bottle right now. And what it does, it's solar-powered. It has a cooling element inside that literally sucks the moisture out of the air. And you can carry it with you as you hike, or you can hook it up to your bike. And it, under prime conditions, the researchers say, or the guys who make it say, you can get up to half a liter of water every hour. It's not quite enough to keep you alive in really hot temperatures, but it's a great start, and you'll never run out of water.
Yeah, if you're walking in the Sahara Desert or in Arizona or something like that, it might be a little iffy, huh?
Right. You're going to have to get some add-on water. But this thing does have implications for countries that are feeling the pinch of our water shortages around the world, in that as climate change dries up places, a lot of these things could help people keep themselves hydrated.
Could be something to look to invest in as well, huh?
Exactly.
Now, what about knowing something you're about to eat? Let's say you're about to, you're looking at a cupcake in that bakery window, and you're going in there and you're saying, I don't know about the calories on this thing. I don't know what it's made up of. Or you go into a supermarket and you say, well, this Twinkie has been on the shelf for the past 3 years. there's something now that will tell you what's inside of it?
Yes. Created by a company called Consumer Physics, which is a Israeli-based company. It is basically a handheld device. It's almost a physical app. You plug it into your smartphone. It shines a beam of light at any object, a rock, an apple, a plant, a tree, your latte. It transmits it. It receives that signal back, transmits it back up to the cloud that analyzes it. It's a spectrometer, basically, and it sends the information, all kinds of information you could imagine, to your smartphone. So if you point it at your cupcake, you can tell that that's not going to be a particularly good dietary decision right away. And they also say all of this information they collect is going into something they call the Encyclopedia of Matter, which will be the first collection of matter. And what you can do with that information, I have no idea. But they say it has great implications for research around the world.
And then there are going to be privacy concerns about this now. How do they know? Why should they know what I'm eating? You know, that's going to come. You know that's going to come, right?
Of course, yeah.
All right, now, I was in China for the past few weeks. Thousands of what they call e-bikes or electric bikes are jamming the cities all over China. Something's happening now as far as a new type of e-bike? Is that just here in the United States? Is that worldwide?
It's not. It's worldwide. The company that's designed this new bike, they come in 8 series, from no gears to 8 gears. It's a company called Van Moof. And this is a lot of e-bikes that you see are pedal assists. Like, the more you pedal, the more it charges up the battery. In this, you charge up the battery, and it will give you an assist for up to 60 kilometers.
Tech report from Kevin Enox, and he'll be with us hopefully on a weekly basis with all very, very cool stuff. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Soul singer Erykah Badu is known as an example of feminism and female strength, but she got into a Twitter war recently when she commented on an article about a school in New Zealand that mandated longer skirt lengths for female students to avoid distracting male teachers and students. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Sean Renee about the controversy and its repercussions.
Erykah Badu is a symbol for creativity, a symbol for empowerment, for freedom of expression. This is the woman who, in the video for her song Window Seat, walked through downtown Dallas naked. So for her to come, you know, later on, years later, and say, if I had a school, I would mandate this, was really shocking and very upsetting to a lot of people. And for 48 hours, this Twitter rant between Erykah and people who agreed with her and people who disagreed with her went on and on and on. And I thought it was a very interesting conversation when it was good natured, because it brought out a number of issues that we don't often talk about, or at least don't talk about enough. And the first one, and she brought this up through her series of tweets, about nature. It is, in her opinion, in a man's nature to be attracted to a woman or a girl who is of childbearing age. And so, as a mother, and she has 2 girls and a teenage boy. So as a mother, she believed that it is her responsibility to teach them that they should dress a bit modestly, just to prevent anything from happening. And then there's that conversation, the nature versus principled. You know, should young men and older men be more principled and say, well, even if I'm attracted, that doesn't give me a right to do anything. And then, again, how we socialize, girls versus boys. And this is a very important topic, especially when it comes to hip hop and certain forms of music. And although she is a neo soul artist, she is also very much ingrained in hip hop culture. And so, you know, hip hop is this hyper masculine culture that will teach young men that to be a man, you must, how can I put this gently?
Be
you must romance as many women.
Be in a relationship with a lot of young women, particularly young women in tight clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
Did I get that okay?
Yes, I think that was a good way to put it.
That's the diplomatic way to put it.
Yeah, yeah. And then also the conversation about how attire determines treatment and whether or not your attire should determine your treatment. And this, again, is a very important conversation for many of her fans because she is popular in the African-American community. And years ago, there was a question about whether or not a hoodie, when Trayvon Martin was killed, whether or not, you know, young black men should be concerned about the kinds of clothes that they wear for fear that they may be mistaken for criminals or thugs or whatever. So this is such an interesting and multi-level conversation in which so many layers are being peeled back. And I would recommend if anyone has some time on Twitter, it'll take you a while to follow it.
And if you want to join into this discussion, her handle, Erica's handle on Twitter is @FatBellyBella. That's B-E-L-L-A. And our handle here is @VOA_IE. If you want to talk about it with Shauna, she is @VOA_music. She's also @VOA Lady DJ. You can log on to our website, also voanews.com.
Now that is our show. We're going to wrap it up now. Please visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. I am in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great evening, great day, wherever you might be around the world.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 20th, the Republic of Congo held presidential elections considered flawed. Marred by widespread irregularities, a media blackout during the polls, an imbalanced and restrictive media environment, significant disparity in access to state resources, a short time frame for electoral preparations, and restrictions on freedoms of expression, communication, and association in the pre-election period. In this political environment, President Denis Sassou Nguesso won a third five-year term in office in an election that officially gave him 60% of the vote. Nguesso, who is 72 years old, decided to run for a third presidential term in fall of 2015. Under the country's constitution, Mr. Nguesso was not eligible to run for a third term and was also disqualified due to his age. In order to remove these obstacles, his government proposed changes to the country's constitution that would enable him to run for a third term. On October 25th of last year, the Congolese government held a deeply flawed referendum to alter the country's constitution, despite massive protests on October 20th and 21st that turned bloody when security forces opened fire into the crowd of protesters, media outlets reporting dozens killed or injured. The ruling party announced that the referendum passed with nearly 93% of the vote. Tensions rose as the opposition disputed the results of the referendum. But another protest planned by the opposition for October 30th was canceled since the ban on protests had not been lifted and opposition leaders feared more bloodletting among their supporters. A similar fate befell a press conference planned for March 25th, during which the opposition planned to announce the results of its parallel vote count. The event was disrupted and then canceled when police used tear gas to disperse the crowd of opposition supporters and arrested many of them. Weeks after the government announced President Sassou's victory in the presidential election, violence has escalated in the capital. Heavy shooting and clashes between security forces and the opposition have led hundreds of residents of southern Brazzaville to flee their homes on foot toward the calmer north of the city. The United States is profoundly disappointed by the flawed presidential electoral process in the Republic of Congo, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner in a written statement. The United States calls upon the Congolese government to correct these numerous deficiencies before scheduling legislative elections in order to bring credibility to future electoral processes. We continue to urge the Congolese government to respect the people's constitutional rights of freedom of expression, movement, and association. We further encourage all parties to engage in constructive, inclusive dialogue.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.